Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. To many teachers around the world, the name of this week's guest is a familiar one, if only as the co-author, with Nathaniel Gage, of a hugely popular and enduring textbook on educational psychology, titled simply Educational Psychology. My guest is David C. Berliner, and despite the fact that that textbook ran to 6 editions, Professor Berliner has many other achievements to his name in the world of education. David C. Berliner is Regents Professor of Education Emeritus at Arizona State University. He has also taught at the Universities of Arizona and Massachusetts, at Teachers College and Stanford University, and at universities in Canada, Australia and Europe. When I met up with David Berliner, I first asked him to tell me how the textbook Educational Psychology came about.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. I had studied at Stanford. I had worked with Gage, but I didn't know him well. And he had done the first handbook of research on teaching, which was a remarkable success, bringing together everything we knew about research on teaching in 1963. I got to Stanford in 1964. That was a Bible for us. The publisher asked him if he would do an ed psych text. He said yes, and for the next 4 years struggled because he just couldn't get it off the ground. Well, he asked Phil Jackson at the University of Chicago to join him as a co-author, and Phil was doing his famous book, Life in Classrooms, around that time. And Phil said, no, I'm not even sure I believe in ed psych anymore. So he asked a young man that had just joined the Stanford faculty, Richard Snow, who was a superb scholar and a wonderful man, became a close friend of mine while I was a student at Stanford. And Snow said, I'm an industrial psychologist, not really an educational psychologist. Why don't you ask Berliner? He was our best graduate student, and he just left, and he knows everything about ed psych. And Gage was impressed with me. I had been in his class, but we didn't know each other very well. But he asked me to join him. And as a young professor, my God, what an opportunity. So I said, of course, yes. And we became fast friends and went through 5 editions. And it was just wonderful to work with a scholar of that detail and breath. One example, I brought in a quote for our Ed Psych book, and he said, I'll bet you a dime it's wrong. And I said, no, it's not. I took that quote after. He said, I'll bet you a dime it's wrong. And it was wrong. A comma misplaced, a period misplaced, a quote misplaced. Gage was right. People don't quote accurately. But that's the kind of perfectionist he was. So it was just wonderful to work with him.
But was that difficult, working with someone who was such a perfectionist?
No, not at all. I, in many ways, I think I knew Ed Psych better than he did, because I had just come through the program. And I had studied with the greatest people in the world at Stanford. So Gage was basically a social psychologist working in education. I was an educational psychologist and had studied with some of the finest people in the field. So in some ways, I knew more about the field than he did, though he was a wonderful scholar, and he was the organizer of the book.
And what was it that brought you to education psychology?
Accident. I had wanted to be a clinical psychologist, and as I learned more about clinical psychology, I realized that most of the clinicians were as crazy as their patients. There was just no scientific basis for their rationales. UCLA, where I did my undergraduate work, had no clinical psych, so they trained me in experimental psych, and they brainwashed me. And by the time I was studying clinical psych, I thought, this stuff is nonsense. So I asked an experimental psychologist if I could work with him, and he said, sure, come on on. And so I was going into experimental psych, possibly into what was called human engineering, where psychologists help people design aircraft cockpits and military systems and industrial designs and buildings that made them human scale. I was fascinated by that, and I'd done some work in that area. My first publication was in that area. And so I applied for experimental psych in Berkeley and Stanford because I was working in Northern California. And Berkeley accepted me, Stanford did not. but sent my papers to the School of Education because I had done an educational research study as part of my master's, post-master's work. And the College of Education looked at my papers and they accepted me. So I got accepted into EdSych and then had to go find out what EdSych was. But the minute I got into the field, it met my clinical needs because it was going to help people and do something maybe, you know, for humanity. When you're a young man, you want to do that. Even an old man wants to do that. So I wanted to do something for humanity, and I wanted to be an experimentalist. EdSych was the perfect marriage for me, and my career just has been wonderful because I just took to it. It was great.
And what do you think that knowledge of psychology contributes to the education and preparation of a teacher?
Psychology is the study of an individual, and we may broaden that, the study of an individual in their social context. And what better discipline to study a child in a classroom, an individual in a social context, a teacher in a classroom, the relationships of teachers and students. I think psychology just gives you insight, but psychology gives you methods, randomized clinical trials as a way of trying to get knowledge. Turns out it's less useful than we thought at the time I was training. Now that I've been in the field for 50 years or so, it's hard to get replicable knowledge in something as complex as a classroom. So while a randomized clinical trial may work fine in some other fields, in educational psychology, it's just very hard. What you learn in Argentina can't be replicated here in Dublin because the context is different and the people are different and parents' interests are different and on and on and on. And replication turns out to be extremely difficult in education. And on the one hand, you could look at it as that scientific education and psychology as a science has very little value. On the other, you can say it's the most wonderful challenge to a psychologist. How do you get reliable knowledge out of something so messy as schools and classrooms? And I think that's the psychologist's job, is to extract the knowledge you can in a messy world.
And for a teacher then, is it the knowledge that they get about psychology, or is it the way of thinking that psychology trains them in that is of benefit to them in doing their work from day to day?
Yeah, it's hard for me to argue that psychology trains the mind in any way. I don't think much does. Teachers have an environment, a classroom nested in a school, nested in a district system, state. But the classroom phenomena is what the teacher has to understand. And there are some ways to run it better. We know something about discipline, what's better, what's worse. We know something about how cooperative learning works and what kinds of outcomes you might get. So the teacher has to take the knowledge that we have, feedback. One of the most important things a kid needs is feedback on what they do. And if teachers figure out how to take our knowledge about feedback and instantiate it in their own classroom, they will get better results. But instantiating our knowledge in a classroom is just not easy to do. But that's our job. Teachers need more supervision and professional development. That's pretty clear because they forget everything. We teach them very quickly as the exigencies of classroom life take over. And we really need more roving developers of teachers so that they stop in classes and remind them what they learned in EdSych. But I think we have knowledge that can be instantiated in classrooms if they're reminded of it. But if not, they're just going to fall under the power of just getting anything done in such a complex classroom. And some do it good, some don't. But I think psychology can tell them how to do it a little better.
And if teachers forget the knowledge so quickly, is it perhaps that the knowledge is not sticky enough for them?
Well, that's possible, but I have a hunch that the first year or two is just so overwhelming in complexity that they're learning to survive, at least in the United States. I assume it's the same here in Dublin and Ireland. They're learning to survive, and when you're learning to survive, the knowledge, the book knowledge you had 2 years ago, just seems irrelevant. But 2 years later, if you can remind them of that book knowledge, you get a whole different idea. If I was czar of teacher education, I would have a rolling program of teacher education. 3, 4, 5 weeks in the field, 3, 4, 5 weeks at the university, 3, 4, 5 weeks in the field, and I do it for 2 years. And that way I can integrate the knowledge base with the practice. But otherwise, we typically teach at the university, send them out, and for the first 2 years, they're overwhelmed in survival. And that's when I can remind them what we try to teach them. So if I could do a rolling teacher training kind of thing, I think we would be much better off, but nobody does it. And when I was dean, I couldn't pull it off. When I was dean of my university college, I couldn't pull off a rolling system, even though I really wanted one. It's very hard to do. Bureaucrats don't let you have courses like that.
That's the bureaucrats at the university.
At the university, yeah. So I couldn't pull it off myself. But ideally, I think that's the way I would do it. And there's some backing to that by philosophers. Beothanel Smith, one of the best philosophers of education in his day, 30, 40 years ago, swore by that system. He said that's the only way to integrate knowledge. And I think he's right.
You've been working in education psychology for a long time. What are the big developments, in your view, that have taken place in the course of your career?
Well, one of them is throwing out educational psychology out of teacher education. It's reduced. It used to be a three-unit course, sometimes six units. It's often three units or one unit, maybe, or two. Tests and measures have been done away with in lots of cases, and I would argue that assessment literacy is mandatory for teachers in this age of metrification. So I would certainly have a course on assessment literacy, and usually that's an educational psychologist who teaches that, but not always. So I would want to see that in for sure. But educational psychology has lost its purchase, but so has history, philosophy. In the U.S. schools, we don't teach history of education much. We don't teach philosophy of education much. We barely teach sociology of education much. It's a practicum-oriented, teaching skill-oriented curriculum that most people are getting now in the U.S., and I think that's a mistake. And it's like saying the liberal arts don't count or the humanities don't count. And there's no way you can specify what a history of education or philosophy of education does for classroom practice, but that's true of lots of courses. I mean, why read Chaucer? What use is Chaucer in this world, okay? What use is learning calculus for 99% of the people in this world? So we have lots of things we still have in the curriculum that are stupid in terms of just practical knowledge. Well, on the other hand, there are people who will defend those things as worthy in and of themselves. Well, I'm making that case for history and philosophy and anthropology and sociology and educational psychology as the kind of background knowledge that makes for a better teacher. But it's hard to specify learning this will result in that. It's just hard to do. But the whole education system is based on that premise. Learn this and you'll be better in life. It's funny that educators have thrown out the humanities and social sciences in the US.
And is that having an adverse effect on the development of educational psychology as a discipline, the fact that it's being studied less in teacher preparation programs?
Doesn't seem to have been so far. They've been able to garner money, and journal articles are certainly up, and a lot of educators have focused on motivation as a topic, a little different than my generation. Lots of us focused on the study of teaching, and I think motivation is now the major topic of educational psychologists, and yeah, certainly that's a worthwhile topic to study. So I don't think the field has been hurt, but the shift away from studying practice, I think, is just not healthy. I always wanted to study practice. When I got into ed psych, I thought, what could be more complex than figuring out a classroom? My God, if I could spend my life trying to understand how this works and make it work better, I'd be doing everything I want to do in life. I'm not sure everybody feels that way. They've given up on practice. So you have a lot of theoretical articles on motivation, and that's nice, and cognition, that's nice. I mean, I'm a psychologist. I love my colleagues and the work they do. But I wanted to study practice, and I wish more people would.
And how did you study practice?
You walk into classrooms and you try to figure out what the hell is going on in here. I'll give you an anecdote, Sean. One of my first work in classrooms as an educational psychologist was coding some teacher behavior. And so I walk in with my coding instrument, and I'm in the back of the room, and I'm coding teacher questions of certain types, and I'm being the objective scientist. And a little kid, I think it was a third grader, little kid comes over and tugs my pant leg. And he says, "Mister, can you help me with this?" Now, this is an existential moment, okay? Am I the scientist who's keeping track of teacher behavior, or am I a human being working with a child? Well, of course I chose the child, and my life changed. I realized that if you're going to study practice, you got to be willing to adapt your science to the world of a teacher. And I think I've done that pretty well in a lot of my work. And I'm kind of proud of it. And some people call me sloppy. Well, okay, I'm a sloppy researcher. I can't control lots of the stuff I found in classrooms. But that doesn't lessen my insights about classrooms. So I like practice. It's so messy. Its complexity is so high that studying it is just a wonderful way to spend 50 years of your life.
So how do you break it down then, if it is so messy? How do you try and bring some order to it? Because presumably that's what you try to do as an educational psychologist.
Well, one of the things I did was decide, well, why don't I study the people who are good at this? So I spent 10 years of my life studying expert teachers. And I found a way to identify them. I found a way to study them in both laboratory situations and in classrooms. And either you model the master teacher or master the teaching model. I was trying to model the master teacher. Okay, how do they do it? And it seems to me that that was as relevant as trying to take an ed psych book and applying it. So I was trying to say, here's somebody we all agree is spectacular. How do they pull that off? Okay, yeah, exactly. And I had a lot of fun for a decade doing that. I had another decade of my life devoted mostly, not solely either time, but another decade of my life studying how teachers spend time in classrooms. And I wrote on that, and we developed a concept out of studying teachers called academic learning time, which, although it sounds immodest, I think is one of the most important concepts ever created in educational psychology that is overlooked. Academic learning time is the time that a kid is engaged and succeeding, and what they're working on is related to the outcome you value. Now, it's a multi-part concept, so people ignore it because they can't deal with concepts that are that big. But if you can code, and we did, the engaged time, the stuff of middle level difficulty or so, and its relationship to the curriculum, you can predict test scores almost easily, 0.8. It's huge. I mean, I have a classroom method to predict the kids' outcomes, and it's very powerful. No one uses it.
Is that at an individual level or at a class level?
At an individual level. We can do the class level too, because you can do attention, you can measure attention at the class level. You scan kids and figure out this class is 70% are engaged. That's the average in a U.S. classroom. But there are classrooms in which 40 and 50% are engaged, and classrooms in which 90% are engaged. Guess which classroom is likely to do better if what they're studying is related to the outcome? Okay, so you have to put a probability that it's related to the outcome.
And is that something that can be applied by a teacher, or does it have to be applied by an external observer?
No, I mean, if you teach a teacher how to kind of code for that and make sense of that, it can be done, you know, seat of the pants. You've got a teacher who can do a better job and know that their kids are learning. They have to be engaged. What they're working on has to be of the proper difficulty, not too easy, not too hard, something in the middle, and it has to be related to the outcomes. And if you can make that claim, you have kids who are going to achieve well on the test. What else can you do? You can't make a child learn, but you can lead them to the right material. You can have it at the right level for them to learn. And it can be related to the outcomes you value. That you can do. You still can't make them learn. But but if you do that, your kids will learn.
If we go on to the other topic that you mentioned that is preoccupying educational psychologists at the moment, motivation, what kind of interesting insights are coming out about motivation with all the focus on that area?
Well, I'm not completely sure, but certainly the notion of feedback as a motivating device, how to get better without putting it into negative or giving little, you know, labels and awards and sticky things to put on your shirt, but just simple feedback as a motivational device, neutral for a kid, turns out to be one of the most powerful things a teacher can do on their essays, on their tests. Instead of the you can do better, which tells a kid they did bad, you can say, you know, if you had changed this and you had changed that, this would have changed the way this paragraph would work and it would be more coherent. And feedback works, but it takes time. And if you have a teacher with 30 kids and they have 5 high school preparations a day, 150 kids a day, how much feedback can they get? So instead they put, you can do better. That's not feedback. So as a motivational device, feedback in a neutral manner turns out to be very powerful. Letting kids have some options about what they read. Why do you care if they read Chaucer or something modern? I don't. My job is to get kids to read and love reading. I read Captain's Courageous, the Rudyard Kipling book. I read it 3 times when I was 12 or 13. I loved it. I loved the little kid in the book. I loved the sea. It was magical for me. That's why I'm a good reader. I found books that were magical. But if I had to read some of the stuff the teachers assigned to me, I'd go crazy. Dewey said it best. Find what kids want to learn and let them learn it. Dewey was right. On the motivational issues, find what kids want to do and use that either as a lever for the things you have to teach them, because as adults we have a right and a duty to specify what people need to know to get along in society. The Magna Carta, the U.S. Constitution, they're not great reading necessarily, but people ought to be aware of those things, I think. But on the other hand, if they want to read some science fiction to build their reading skills, to build their motivation, why not? I just don't understand why we have to specify certain things.
You also co-authored a book called Putting Research to Work in Your School. How much do you think teachers draw on educational research in their work?
Generally, not much at all. That's why we wrote the book, Putting Research to Work in Your Schools. I worked with my wife, Ursula Casanova, who was a school teacher, school principal, before she became an academic. And we did a column for about 8 years for a teacher magazine. If you think of the book, the magazine opened, on one page it would say research, and then the other page it would say practice. Then they faced each other. And I would describe in one magazine page a research study, and then she would describe in the other page what it means for a principal or teacher. Okay? And it was very successful for about 8 years. And we packaged that into the book, Research and Practice. And we got letters and phone calls from all over the world about people using our ideas and thanking us, and that was great. But it has to be in a form packaged something like that, where the research is made meaningful to teachers to use. And we typically, educational psychologists, and other social scientists get advanced by journal articles, not by writing for teachers. And if you're going to get tenure and raises, you don't care about teachers, which is part of the problem of a school of education. And why my career was a little oddball by being concerned with practice. And by the way, they have a new award at the American Educational Research Association, first time offered this year, on communicating research to policy and practice. I won the award. And I'm very proud of that, that somebody recognized that my career was worthwhile, you know, that I did something not everybody does, because I didn't particularly care about how quickly I gained my tenure or my professorship. I just did my work, and it got me everything.
Yeah. And why did the work that you did with your wife, that one-page research, one-page practice, why did that come to an end? That seems such a pity.
I thought so. I'm glad you thought so too, but you were not the publisher of the magazine. And every few years they get a different publisher or editor in and they want new stuff. Okay, so they said, thanks a lot, see you. So we repackaged it for the book, and we were going to do a second version of it, but I got interested in other things, and my wife started studying a school and wrote a book about that. So you know, you can spend your whole life in one area if you want. That's okay. But I changed my focus roughly every 10 years, and so did my wonderful colleague, Jean Glass, one of the finest scholars in the world. And we both agreed that, you know, every few years, you've done what you want to do in an area, and it's time to move to a different area. And that's okay. So we let it go, even though we had a good time doing this for 8 years. And working with teachers, and we piggybacked that project into another one that was also, I think, very successful and not picked up. We packaged research for teachers in a very peculiar way. This might answer your question. we would take a topic, let's say homework, and we would find some articles in homework, maybe 10, 12 articles, set them up in a loose leaf book, and annotate them so that a teacher can read a difficult research article that's using multiple regression to find this and that. And we would just imagine the face page of the research article and an open area next to it where we would annotate. This is where the researcher is trying to see if there's a statistically significant difference. Don't pay any attention to the statistics. That's not your interest. That's the research community's interest. The question is, did they find something that seems to be non-chance? And then we have an arrow, okay? And we say, here's where they say, this is probably worth taking seriously, okay? And so we would annotate the articles on homework, and we packaged these in, we did this in 10 areas, homework, parent involvement, phonics, I forget, 10 areas. And we gave them to teacher study groups. And we said, take a few weeks, 5, 6, 7 teachers, and see what you do. One of the study groups took the homework stuff, went to their school board and changed the homework policy in their district. So we couldn't have been more pleased. But teachers weren't getting credit for it. Teachers are tired. Teachers are busy. This would have been a perfect way to have teacher staff development, professional development. And the NEA gave them out to everybody.
The
National Education Association sponsored our work. One state went crazy with them and loved it, Iowa. But we couldn't get purchase with it. Again, I think because teachers are busy and tired. And asking them to have a study session once every 2 weeks on some research topic is, that's pushing the limits of a teacher. They have families, they have other things, and big classes, etc. But it seemed to have worked as a way to get the research more into practice.
Yeah, because it always seems such a pity that it is so difficult for teachers to access research, you know, with all these firewalls and subscription
right.
payments and things like that.
Yeah, but remember, physicians have the same problem. That's even scarier.
And that somewhat worrying note about doctors and research brings to a close the first part of my interview with Professor David Berliner. I'll bring you the second part of my interview with David Berliner on next week's programme. You can listen to or download podcasts of over 260 previous editions of Inside Education on seandelaney.com/podcasts. You can get in touch with me by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.